It's the pseudo edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, worldwide witch hunt, pseudoscience censorship, New Year's resolution, a Radio Free Thinker testimonial, and CeeLo's imagination. Let's begin episode 148.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords for politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello, and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher, and we have a special guest in the audience,
Audience in studio. It's Andrew, mathematician friend of Don.
Cool. Friend of Don.
That must be an awesome and prestigious title to be wearing.
There are better ones, but it's a pretty good one.
Oh.
So what brings Andrew to Radio Free Thinker today?
Yeah, just generally. Tell us a bit about where you do, what you come from, your history.
I'm a PhD student in math at UWaterloo in Ontario, and I'm here today to give some testimonials about Radio Free Thinker and how it's changed my life.
Cool. I'm sure we'll go into some more specific details later on in the show. So you're into math.
Yes.
So, like, that's sort of that work of fiction, right? Because we all know that math doesn't actually relate to the world. There's a correlation, but there's no real causation.
This is a very philosophical question, Don. Very, very
funny deep philosopher of the show would have brought it up.
Yeah, imagine that.
Yes. Mm. Actually, that reminds me, and I'm going to need to put up a piece of wood between me and Andrew. Ethan, mm-hmm. Do you believe in infinity?
Do I believe in infinity?
This is a long-standing argument.
We have been talking about this for, I swear, decades. I believe infinity is a fictional entity. It actually doesn't exist. It's not real in any sense of the word. But of course, it's necessary for math. Otherwise,
it's so useful.
It just doesn't. Math doesn't work without this illusion, delusion, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah. This is a long-standing argument, and we could fill up the entire episode with
that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Speaking of delusions and illusions, he said in a great segue. Worldwide witch hunt. Well, we've kind of talked about this before, but again. I saw in the news last month, Saudi Arabia has executed another woman for practicing witchcraft and sorcery. This is on top of a Sudanese man who was executed in September on similar charges, despite, of course, Amnesty International saying, hey, you know, let him go, this is all sort of nuts sort of stuff. Last year, a Lebanese man was facing the death penalty, but he did get off. He was actually charged because he did a fortune-telling television program, he presented one. But the Saudi Supreme Court decreed that his actions did not actually harm anyone. So I'm not quite sure why you get executed or not. It all seems to be sort of sorcery. 2007, an Egyptian national was beheaded, allegedly for casting spells in an attempt to separate a married couple. That and maybe his cooking might have done it. I mean, that's caused some couples to... Yeah, okay. Apparently, Amnesty International points out that Saudi Arabia doesn't actually define sorcery as a capital offense. But a lot of the clerics in there think it should be punished, and obviously it has been punished with the death penalty on more than one occasion. It's kind of hard to think that in this day and age that witch hunts have not been relegated to the history books. However, you'd be wrong. As it's already stated, Saudi Arabia is kind of going through a resurgence of witch killings. There are a number of places in the world where witchcraft is still considered illegal. Papua New Guinea has a 1976 Sorcery Act, and even India has something called the Witchcraft Prevention Act of 2005. So, I mean, like, it still seems to be a current thing, even what we would consider to be progressive-type nations. I mean, India is not exactly a throwback to the 4th century or anything like that. Of course, there have been a number of extra-legal killings throughout the world, Guyana, Nigeria, and various other parts of Africa, largely but not exclusively thanks to the rise of Pentecostal fundamentalism, which, of course, believes in speaking of tongues, demon possession, and witchcraft is just all part of that. A number of the more nativistic religions think that witchcraft is either part of, it's part of the voodoo of this of the local land. Of course, in Canada, the last witch trial happened in, well, and I was surprised to find out this, apparently never. We managed to sort of skate by the whole thing. I did come across one somewhat dubious report that apparently three people might have been prosecuted of witchcraft in the 1700s in New France, but I could never find anything that really substantiated that to any degree, so I would consider that to be dubious at best. The Americans, of course, were off in them left, right, and center and around that same time. However, in modern times, a number of people have actually been convicted in Canada, sort of our own sort of modern version of witchcraft mania, with the most notable recently being in 2010, where a woman pleaded guilty for fraudulently practicing witchcraft. It's funny, actually. It is a crime in Canada. It's not a crime in Canada to be a witch, but it is a crime in Canada to pretend to be a witch. The Canada Criminal Code, Section 365, anyone can look that up. Pretending to practice witchcraft. Anyone who fraudulently pretends to exercise or use any kind of witchcraft, sorcery, enchantment, or conjuration undertakes for the consideration to fortune tell. And there are a hell of a lot of fortune tellers downtown, aren't there? I just would have swore I've seen them.
Yeah.
Or pretends...
Are they certified by the Canadian government or something?
Well, yeah. So, again, this is... So, and again, if you use any kind of occult or crafty science... And actually, that's another word I love. Crafty science. in order to say, hey, I can find your lost or stolen object, you are summarily convicted of a crime. And, I mean, one, it seems weird that we would level up. I mean, if I pretended to be the Prince of Mars and duped you of some money, that's just considered fraud. But there's this special little consideration where if I do the exact same thing, but say that I'm a warlock, and if you don't give me the money, I'll cast a spell on you. And assuming, of course, I'm not really a warlock, because I guess if I really was a warlock, you couldn't do anything to me.
Well, I mean, I recall, we've discussed this on the show before, but based on these laws, in theory, you or I could sue a fortune teller in Vancouver for being a fraudulent witch. We could sue John Edwards, for instance.
Yeah.
We could sue Sylvia Brown for not being, for them faking their witchcraft. So I'm pretty sure they're faking their witchcraft.
Well, and that, of course, leads... I mean, because, I mean, the origin of all this, obviously, is, as much as we hate to admit it, most countries do have a Christian hangover from its origins. And at one point, they wanted to take witchcraft as separate because that was considered a threat to religion. And so they wanted to make that a special extra crime. Mm-hmm. So that's why I think these laws exist in our law books as separate things. But you're right. But then, of course, Edwards or them would come back and say... Well, how do you prove that I'm not a witch? Mm-hmm. Which, of course, in itself would be great for the press because then we could say Edwards admits he's a witch and then, you know, working with sorcery. Ooh.
That's like one of those times where I think you can sort of use the system to show how ridiculous the system actually is.
Yes.
I encourage skeptical groups out there to sue John Edwards for being a witch.
Yes. Well, fraudulently. Fraudulently being a witch.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, and actually, you know, because he does, he finds lost and stolen property too all the time, from what I understand, right?
Well, he claims to.
But speaking of being fraudulent or not respecting the memory of...
Yes, well, that leads on to our next bit of skeptical news here. The internet is abuzz over the recent actions of CeeLo, a musician and entertainer, who sung John Lennon's song Imagine on the NBC New Year's Eve with Carson Daly. CeeLo, whose real name is Thomas DiCarlo Calloway, got people, especially non-believers who like John Lennon, all excited when they heard that he was going to be doing a cover of the song Imagine.
Just for reference, for those people who don't know who CeeLo is, he's the one, and mother, please don't listen to the show, he's one who did the song Fuck You, which got censored to Forget You.
Mm-hmm.
So if you know that song, it's like, oh, that's the person we're talking about.
Yeah. But the excitement that Calloway brought up evaporated and turned to rage When they heard his version of the song, Calloway changed one of the most recognizable lines in the song. Now, normally, the lyrics go, "Imagine there's no countries, it isn't hard to do, nothing to kill or die for, and no religion too."
Woo! No religion, we love that line.
Yes. But this is how Calloway sang it. "Imagine there's no countries, it isn't hard to do, nothing to kill and die for, and all religion's true." Now, when people started hearing about this, they were outraged. Calloway, attempting some damage control, tweeted in response, "Yo, I meant no disrespect by changing the lyric, guys. I was trying to say a world where you could believe what you wanted, that's all." So, whether or not he was aware of the sort of anger he would arise by changing one of the most popular songs in history, or whether he was just, you know, not very, not thinking very clearly about the issue, whatever, that's kind of beside the point. There are several reasons here why people might be annoyed, if not outright angry. See, if Calloway was just trying to avoid controversy, fine. But what he did was he changed the meaning behind Lennon's song.
I'm going to put you on the spot here.
Okay.
Sorry, I just thought of this right this moment.
Okay, fine.
So you said if he wasn't intending to change them, like if he was just doing this to be more politically correct,
yeah,
how would you have had him change it so that, you know, he doesn't bastardize the memory of Lennon, but at the same time, he falls in that PC correct thing?
Well, I'm not CeeLo. I'm not going to come up with a reason for him. If he doesn't want to avoid controversy, don't sing the song.
Like, yeah.
Simple as that. So, changing the meaning behind Lennon's song. Why is this important? Well, Lennon wrote the song to have a specific impact on the audience. By changing the lines, you rewrite that meaning, and you change the intention of the song. Now, for Calloway, he's annoyed non-believers who identify with the song. He's also annoyed Lennon fans, who are pretty devoted in their own right to Lennon. So he's kind of got these two annoyed factions, a sort of small group of non-believers who are, "Oh, you've changed one of our anthems," to the sort of, you know, John Lennon fans who, "You've, you know, desecrated our God's work."
I would probably say our idol's work, I think.
Well, some of these fans...
Using the G word just kind of confounds the...
Yeah, some of these fans, though, they take it pretty seriously. No, okay, so perhaps we're on the wrong foot on this one, though. I mean, when you look at all the covers of famous songs, things have been changed, and sometimes the tone of the song has been changed. And one of my favorite Beatles songs, with a little help from my friends, the way the Beatles sang it, it was sort of like uplifting fun, and it's got that Sgt. Pepper's good vibe to it. But you could listen to the cover by Joe Cocker, and the lines all say the same, but the tone and the pacing of the song are totally different. And this causes the mood of the song to have an entirely different feel to it. So why is it okay for, you know, Cocker to do that, but Calloway to not do what he did with Lennon's song? Well, the answer is in the details. Calloway changed the line from "and no religion to "all religion's true." If he had made it sound something like "and religion is wrong," or "we won't have religion," or something that still rhymed, fine, he's altered the lyrics, but he's kept the original intention of the song there. But that's not what he did. He actually changed the lyrics to something that meant the opposite of what Lennon was trying to say in his song. Which is different, I think, from when another musician covers a song, changing maybe some of the lyrics here or there, or adds a different melody or changes the tone of the song. They're still respecting the initial message behind the song.
Now, uncharacteristically, and I feel uncomfortable in this role, but I'm going to play devil's advocate and sort of defend CeeLo here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one, from a very pedantic sort of philosophical point of view, all religions being true is a internally contradictory statement. So
sure.
it itself automatically becomes false. So in that sense, saying no religions are true and all religions are true are almost they're logically equivalent, because you can't have all religions being true. It self negates itself.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, he hasn't actually changed anything in the original intent from a philosophical sort of standpoint.
Assuming all his fans are philosophers.
Right. And as we kind of talked beforehand, and to give CeeLo a bit of credit, he is a pop star artist. He is not some deep thinker. He is not some political, "Hey, I want to make this big stand so everyone," like we were talking, Lady Gaga. If Lady Gaga had done something similar to this, and there might be a better person that I don't know of, not being that up in pop culture, that would have had an entirely different layer to this whole thing, because you know not only are they doing the song, but they actually have this sort of political intention behind it. Whereas you look at him, and I mean, we were talking before the show about the idea of not having any money, getting rid of all the money, and him singing this in this, like, what has to be either incredibly cheap, like incredibly fake, or very expensive fur coat that he's wearing, right? I mean, yeah. So it was dripping with irony in that sense. But when John Lennon originally did his song, he was doing it to a Christian-type nation, where religion, it was Christian religion, it was the dominant religion, and if you didn't believe in it, you were a godless atheist, because you'd be compared to the communists of the day. Mm-hmm. So saying no religion was sort of making a stance against that. In the United States right now, it's more of our religion is true, their religion is false, as in Islam, or Judaism, or what have you. So the idea of tolerance amongst religion might be a bigger counterpoint now than it would have been in John Lennon. So in an odd sort of way, saying, as he kind of tried to explain later on, and I'll give him credit that he's not lying, that he's saying, well, listen, you know, we all have our own beliefs, let's just see if we can all get along, might actually have more resonance in the United States today than it would have in Lennon's day, or Lennon's message would have today. Mm-hmm. I mean, as an atheist, I'm all for Lennon's original message, and I'm not trying to defend it in that sense, but to give him the benefit of the doubt.
Sure. I mean, like, I don't think he did this maliciously. I don't think he sat down and was like, yes, now I'm going to promote my Christian values on these people. But at the same time, if he felt that uncomfortable about the song, he should have picked a different song, in my opinion.
But how much does an artist have to abide by the intentions of the original artist when they do a cover?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, like, depending on what stipulations whoever owns the rights to the song places on cover versions, they could be very strict or they could be loosey-goosey. Who knows? I actually don't know that. Mm-hmm. I don't even know who owns. Does Lennon own... Does his family own his songs? Or
I think Ono. Yoko. Yeah. Ono.
Because I know that some artists are pretty fastidious that if you're going to cover their songs, you have to cover it their way.
Yeah.
Whereas some artists, you know, they let you cover their songs any way you want.
Is this laid down posthumously as well?
What's that?
Like, if an artist is dead, oh, do they still have the same ability to restrict covers?
Oh, yeah, no, because you have the rights go to your estate.
Right.
And then whoever controls your estate controls that. Copyright is so bizarre and lasts now forever.
Yeah. Well, the fact that Michael Jackson used to own most of the Beatles songs anyway, so...
Exactly.
So what's his estate said? John Lennon's estate or Yoko?
No one... Actually, we haven't heard from that yet. You know, in an odd sort of way, too, and this is kind of playing off what you were saying there, Andrew. If one of the things that a quote-unquote protest song is intended to do is to create a firestorm of controversy in the media, if he had done the original lyric, it would have been, right? You may have one or two Christian groups that would have said something, as in the whole war against Christmas sort of idea, but it probably would have been somewhat muted.
Mm-hmm.
But in him doing what he did do, he has poked the atheist bear, and he has been suitably swatted down.
Yes. Well, I'm actually kind of curious to see if we do hear anything from the supposed rights holders of the songs, if indeed that is, you know, Yoko or Lennon's estate. But I'd be curious to see.
Yes.
Well, why don't we go to a commercial break here on Radio Freethinker, and we'll be back with more after this.
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Science is the best tool ever devised for understanding how the world.
To subscribe to the Radio Freethinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Understanding empowers you.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker.
You know, we had a very interesting discussion about how someone can change lyrics and how the repercussions can be, you know, how the community reacts to that.
Mm-hmm.
And we have another one where community is reacting to someone's particular belief system.
Really?
We actually talked kind of about this a while ago, about a different particular professor in the United States who was a creationist and a cosmologist.
And he was upset that he lost a job.
He lost a job. He applied for a job. Well, this is sort of, well, the same thing but different. University of Louisiana professor is suing his university for violation of his First Amendment rights for criticizing his methods as well as preventing him from teaching. Professor John Aller Jr., who worked in the Communication Disorders Department, claimed the Dean of Arts became hostile to his theories and systematically excluded him from teaching. There have been reductions in his class size, a banning of his self-authorized book, a lack of lecture opportunities, and, according to Aller, a general ostracization by his fellow professors. Communicative Disorders Department deals with topics like autism, dyslexia, and learning disabilities that affect communication. Aller himself specialized in sign language, but more recently has focused on autism. In 2010, he published a book, Autism, The Diagnosis, Treatment, and Etiology of Undeniable Epidemic. And just to give you guys a hint as to where we might go with this, the foreword was written by Andrew Wakefield.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yes. For those people who don't know who Andrew Wakefield is, he is the now infamous, now disbarred, disbanded, and discredited author of a study that was published in the British Journal of Medicine.
The Lancet.
That Lancet. That said that vaccination caused or was linked to autism. It has been found out since that he was quite fraudulent and all that. But even after that, he still got forwarded for this guy's book. In the book, Aller promotes the false link between vaccination and the supposed autism epidemic. But remember, his expertise is linguistics. It's not immunology or biology, so it's kind of an off topic for him. There is more. He is also a believer in intelligent design and creationism, which I admit is a bit of an ad hominem attack, considering, again, his topic. But it is important in that he has spoken many times to the Louisiana legislature as an expert to promote the teaching of intelligent design in Louisiana high school biology curriculum. And of course, when he goes to these presentations, he's presented as a doctor, as a representative from the University of Louisiana, and it's not mentioned that he's a linguist, not a biologist.
Mm-hmm.
Aller is also a tenured professor. So that is, unless he essentially kills a student, he can't be fired. Usually tenure protects professors from inappropriate persecution. However, occasionally, the discrimination is warranted, as I think in this particular case. Aller has used his academic and teaching platform to espouse his outlandish theories, theories in fields that are not actually his area of expertise. It is because of this that the department attempted to limit the damage he could do in his attempt to, in my editorializing, pollute students' minds. The dean and several faculty members, and from what I read, there doesn't seem to be anyone in the department that actually supports him, mentioned that on several occasions they've had to deal with issues arising from Aller's teacher, and that they've been told by many other professionals that his presence actually hurts the department's credibility. He is, in part, being defended by the ADF, the Alliance Defense Fund, a servant organization that provides the resources that will keep the door open to the spread of gospel through the legal defense of religious freedoms, the sanctity of life, and marriage and family. Again, last part's a bit of an ad hominem, but what do you guys think? So, he's a professor, and he teaches linguistics, you know, he seems to have this very nutty idea, and nutty, as in the scientific evidence, does not support it in any way, mm-hmm. about autism. Does that mean he should not be allowed to teach his classes?
I'd say yes, because he's going outside of his realm of expertise. And at this case, like I have lost sympathy for anyone who exposes the vaccination autism link. It now takes a significant degree of not just cognitive dissonance, but outright dishonest academic research to seriously make this claim, ignore the evidence that your claim is wrong, and then hide behind the notion that you're being conspired against. If this person is making this claim, then he has no place in any academic institution that values its reputation or its intellectual honesty.
So you're sort of saying that irrespective of whether he's talking about his fields or not, he has proven such intellectual dishonesty,
mm-hmm.
that it doesn't matter what his field of expertise is, as an academic, he has, on his face, failed.
Yes, absolutely.
If only we had a grad student handy who might be able to give us a deeper insight into that whole area.
Well, one of the first things that kind of occurred was, like, there's a lot of professors I know that really would rather not teach, but it's a burden that they take on as part of, in addition to their research and other responsibilities. So if the university is asking him to not teach,
he should see this as a boon.
Like, he's more time to do research and all the other things that he really cares about in some sense. So, like, the fact that he's not teaching isn't something that the university is wronging him in, because lots of people want out of teaching as professors, I think. And ostracization by your community seems like a standard thing. Like, in the scientific community, if you're talking crazy, you're not going to get published, you're not going to get a lot of talks, you're not going to get the respect.
But what about his attempt to remediate that by basically claiming his First Amendment rights, which wouldn't be First Amendment here, but we do have the right to freedom of speech and that sort of thing. I mean, do many professors think of going down that road to say, hey, listen, I have this unique, because I'm sure they would say it's a unique idea, I have not been given the academic space I think I deserve, therefore I'm going to sue my institution to force them to give me that space to say what I want.
Well, you guys probably have more experience with this than I do, but it seems strange for me, say, to pay for you to have a platform to speak your crazy ideas.
Yeah, like, I could sue UBC for not giving me a platform to talk about, you know, the flat earth theory or something, right?
It's surprising you mention that, because Andrew, as a mathematician, believes in the flat earth. No,
he doesn't. No, I don't.
That's Andrew's big...
That's the thing I champion. Yeah.
So that actually leads to another thing that we also touched upon. So you're in a mathematical department. Let's say one of your professors who teaches the topic well, but is, let's say, either a creationist, believes that the American government is run by lizards in people's clothing. Do you think that, you know, even though in their particular field they're behaving properly, if they have this extra baggage, is that important, A, for the teaching, or B, for the whole image of the department itself?
I'm in a slightly rarefied universe academically, because it doesn't really matter for math. You can have all sorts of personal craziness, and your math can be quite solid, because, as you say, it's...
fiction.
It's this... not fiction is strong, but it's an abstract world.
You're your first person. People agree with me.
So there is no easy connection for crazy ideas to come into a math class. It's just not, like, we can start talking about manifolds suddenly in the class, and we jump to anti-vax stuff. That's a hard connection for a math class.
No, but do you think the reputation of the instructor can sully the reputation of the department? And again, as we go farther afield from his area of specialty, maybe it has to be much more out there. But I mean, do you think that teaching professors have a certain responsibility to maintain the academic integrity of the department they're in?
Over and above their field of study?
Over and above their actual performance at the work.
That's a really delicate question. I want to say no. I want to say that their personal life is their personal life, but I think their interactions with colleagues and their... what's the word? I'm not as good as this as you guys. Their reputation amongst their fellows matters, and so if they're not interacting and collaborating with people, they're just not going to do that well.
But
they're going to be isolated.
We should make a point, though, that we're not just talking about what he does in his personal life. That's his business. He's trading on his reputation as a professor, as a member of this university, and trying to lend little credibility to some disgraced ideas, right? So, I mean, it's not like he goes out to, you know, wild parties at night and does wild things. It's that he's attaching himself to Andrew Wakefield, a man who, by all intents, should be in jail for what he's done.
Well, and that's what I was trying to get at, is that, I mean, as far as we know, right, and we don't know this for sure, his actual work in linguistics and teaching people with autism may be completely above board. He may be actually a very good academic in that field.
Yeah.
But he has this extra baggage that he carries, some of it in his department, but some of it not. Again, going to the legislature of the Louisiana legislature to promote intelligent design. Nothing to do with his actual academic work, but it does bring discredit upon the university and upon his department that, hey, you guys would hire someone like this. Now, granted, actually, maybe it's not quite as discrediting for Louisiana because we have our prejudice against southern states.
I mean, even if we took it out of that kind of realm, like let's say something that we could consider something we all agree with, like space exploration, right? We certainly think it's a pretty cool thing. And occasionally Congress will bring in Lawrence Krauss or Neil deGrasse Tyson. But if they brought in Steve Novella, a medical doctor, to talk about space exploration, we'd be going, well, wait a sec here. You know, Steve Novella's a cool guy, but he's not an expert on space. Why is he going to Congress to talk about space? He's not an expert on space.
But who would you criticize? Would you criticize Steve Novella for talking about something that he doesn't really know about? Or would you criticize the Congress for listening to someone who actually has no credentials in the area of which you're talking about?
I think I'd criticize both. I think it's a two-way street. I mean, it's one thing to give somebody a pulpit to promote something they know nothing about. And it's another thing for that person to accept the pulpit, right? Like, I mean, there's a certain responsibility on both the people giving this person the ability to speak and the person speaking the nonsense. So, in this case, like, again, I really have no sympathy for this person.
No, again, there's the three different levels. I mean, one, he is using his academic teaching position to promote something that he should not be promoting.
Mm-hmm.
Two, he does have this extra baggage, which is bringing discredit upon his academic field. I guess it's just a two. Sorry.
That's okay.
Two, I like threes. Two. I always think everything should have threes.
Well, he might be a jerk, so we can throw that in there, too.
Yes.
So I think having the particular beliefs he does isn't that terrible, but I think, as you say, it's the trading on his position that is the actual
Bringing it into his classroom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, again, if he just stuck, because his book, obviously, I mean, has the foreword, and his book implies that there's an unnatural epidemic, and he ties in the book it with vaccination. When you bring that into the classroom, that is going, one, beyond what he knows, because, again, it's biology and immunology, not his areas of expertise.
Mm-hmm.
And two, what does that actually have to do with teaching people communicative skills?
Exactly. And the added baggage of having Wakefield's name attached to it as well.
Yes.
Well, why don't we go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back with more after this.
Radio.
CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Radio. Yep. Happy. Boing.
In the sky, standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker.
And as we mentioned, we have Andrew Brown, a Radio Free Thinker Testimonial. Fan testimonial. Yep. Andrew Brown, who I should point out at the beginning, has never actually been convicted of any murder crimes. As far as Revenue Canada, he has never actually laundered any illegal money, and his mom probably could look at his computer without having to phone the police. With all those positive notes... Okay, no, well, he's a brilliant individual. I've known him for more years than I care to admit. He has done a wide variety of things in his life, but a little over a year ago, he started listening to Radio Free Thinker regularly, and he has told me on more than one occasion, it has changed his life.
Andrew, change my life.
In what sort of ways has Radio Free Thinker had an impact on your life?
Well, one of the things that I noticed right away was, like, I'm getting news from sources I kind of trust, though I know how biased Don can be. I trusted the rest of the Radio Free Thinker crew to help filter Don a bit and get some of the good news to me. And
we
so
are
that,
the sieve.
You are the
Dawn.
Sieve.
This is what happens when you have long-term friends. You have to put up with the bolt stuff.
So yeah, I listen to you guys like very regularly. At the gym, all sorts of places. Even Iceland, I've listened to you.
Nice.
So,
was this post or pre the meltdown of Iceland?
This was just this past summer.
Oh, so you could buy like stuff there for like free because...
Oh, no.
Oh, really?
Prices were crazy.
That's... Oh.
Economic meltdown was... It's going the other way. Prices are crazy. But yeah, I've had other little things like the... What is it? The cell phone cancer... debates that you guys keep bringing up and again, and I like that, and I agree with all of that stuff, and I've read a number of other articles that support you guys, and I'm fully in agreement that it's a crazy idea that they're causing cancer.
Well, let's get you know a non sort of professional skeptic's opinion, because you have on occasion sent me links.
Yes.
That you said, hey, there's this study that says if you go anywhere within 500 feet of a cell phone, it will not only kill you, but it will hunt down your family and kill them. To which, of course, you know, I appreciate these links, and we track them down. Occasionally they make it onto our show, occasionally they don't. So when you go out into the infoverse and you see these things, how did you treat them originally, and has it changed how you treat them now?
I originally thought the idea seemed kind of crazy, just because it's radio waves, and it didn't seem like the mechanism made much sense to me from what little physics I knew. And then I heard you guys talking about it, and that's basically the debunking that you guys go through and all the other scientists go through. And I send those links to you because they are saying the opposite. They're like seemingly legitimate people saying the opposite. And I'm basically like, how do you tear this apart? I don't know. I don't have the background or the time to pull this apart. That's why I rely on Radio Freethinker to do some of my thinking for me.
We have extra brains, but we don't mind that burden.
Yeah, that's good.
But yeah, it's the trouble of trying to convince friends around me of these points that's been hard. There's a couple of friends that are very, very worried about cell phones causing cancer, and I'm constantly like sending them the articles you send me and trying to point them to your show and stuff like that, but it's not sticking.
So again, when you talk to your friends, what kind of concerns do they seem to bring up? And besides forwarding...
Personal
links I send to you.
It's personal. Like they always feel something when they're using the cell phone, and I really just want to like confirmation bias. You're remembering the times when you felt whatever it is you felt, and not remembering the times that you didn't. So
you'd be amazed how people don't realize that our body's covered in hairs, and that when we bring any object, especially one that may actually have a bit of a static cling to it, that we may feel something that's just the object.
Well, you mentioned how people will focus on their sort of personal experiences, their personal anecdotes. And that's one of the challenges I think we as skeptics have, is trying to convince people that their personal experiences are quite not valuable as ways of determining what's going on in the world. They're sort of hindrances in many ways. They actually make it worse for you to try to figure out what's going on in the world. And that's a very difficult thing to break through when you're trying to convince somebody of something.
Yeah, it's very hard. Yeah. And it's hard to actually get at it without really insulting them really fast.
Absolutely. That's one of the challenges. And we've talked about this before in the past, of ways to sort of get around that, to help people understand something without making them feel like an idiot. And that's, I think, actually the challenge of skepticism in general, is that we're trying to help somebody without making them feel like a moron.
Yeah, speak for yourself, you idiot.
Well done, John.
But a few other things. You guys have led me to a couple very good articles. One in particular has helped me with like a medical issue that I had for a while. Long, long ago, in the very early days of the show. I can't remember who brought it up, but there was a website you brought up called saveyourself.ca. Mm-hmm. Do you guys remember that?
Oh, yes. The fellow who does that website, Paul Ingram, is a good friend of the show.
Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah, and I checked it out and signed up for it, and his tips and no-nonsense talking about the science and the problems has really, really helped me out with my back issue, basically.
Right.
And so that was a massive help that you guys connected me to. So yeah.
Prior to that, were you a frequenter of chiropractic clinics?
No, I'd actually, long ago, before I even went to university, a friend of mine, who's also a deep, deep skeptic, told me about the craziness of chiropractors. Mm-hmm. And I'd never really used them or seen anyone use them before that, so I was never...
But it must have been tempting, especially when you were in the deepest darkness of your, quote, back issues. You go to some of these shops and they have these nice little posters saying, hey, buy this foot pad and it will improve your immune system, it'll cure all your problems, it'll realign your bioenergies. And although part of you is sitting there saying, I don't really believe in bioenergies, my back hurts, this is offering me some form of help, it must be tempting to just let those skeptic guards down because you are looking for something.
With all of these kind of woo things, if you don't believe it yourself, in their belief frame, that's you won't get the benefits, right? So if you believe that woo stuff, then you can get benefit from it. But if you're skeptical of it, like I've always been, you can't even in theory get the benefits. Like even if it's partially true and you kind of want to believe it, you're still deep down skeptical, and that's going to ruin it for you, according to the pros, the woo pros.
Right.
And I guess the last one I'll mention was a friend of mine about it's homeopathy, and I know how you guys love homeopathy.
Yeah, we.
But I'd never had an incident where I could actually point to the harm of it in such a clear way. And a friend of mine talked about her cat. She has a cat. And for whatever reason, pre this period, she took her cat to a homeopathic vet. The cat was having some kind of crazy reaction to stuff, was like losing fur and was clearly in pain and suffering. And so the homeopathic practitioner?
Yeah.
Vet, whatever.
Fake-titioner.
Fake-titioner. Recommended this course of treatment that was, I think, probably just water, or pretty damn close to it.
Yeah. This is one of those odd sort of things about homeopathy. If you are a true practicing homeopathic sort of doctor, it has to be water, and it's only the memory of the substance. But some actually homeopathic practitioners or fake-titioners, what they do is actually they're trying to use herbal medicine. Like they're sort of blurring the difference between homeopathy and naturopathy. And naturopathy is more herbal, ancient remedies. So sometimes you're actually getting an active ingredient, not the one you think you're getting, but I mean, there could be all sorts of...
The memory of it?
Yeah, well, again, because if you're dealing with fiction, there is no real rule you have to follow. I mean, it's all kind of made up. So if you want to sort of work fast and loose with the fiction, hey. But poor cat.
Before I had listened to your show, I wouldn't have known what she was talking about. I wouldn't have had any idea. I would have been like, oh, what's homeopathy? I know that sounds like an interesting treatment, perhaps. But after your show, I was sitting there very skeptically, and I didn't have to say anything because she basically said that after a year of homeopathic treatment, very expensive, the cat wasn't getting better. And consistently throughout that, the practitioner was saying stuff like defending the practice of homeopathy, saying, oh, if you just take her to a normal vet, the cat will get injected full of hormones and
chemicals
and bad things, right? And the cat just continued to get worse and worse and worse over the year. And my friend basically had enough and went to a real vet and got some steroids.
Okay.
Steroids. And, like, it turned out it was an allergic reaction, and the cat was fine within a week.
Wow. You know, it's funny. Actually, you know, there's even something more sinister about this now that the way you're describing it, and I'm going to assume you described that 100% accurately.
Oh, you might not go there.
We'll pretend. Well, you had mentioned that the homeopathic factitioner was sitting there and said, well, don't go there because they're going to put him through used hormones, but he might have said steroids.
Yeah, I think
so. There's sort of an implication that he actually knew what was probably wrong with the cat. Right, because I mean, just because you're someone who does homeopathy, doesn't mean you're completely ignorant of the world.
I think they knew essentially what it was eventually, but not early on. Right. They were trying.
But again, he's trying to. I mean, because again, I laugh at people who sit there and say, "Oh, don't go to a real doctor because you have to worry about big pharma. You know, they're out to get your money." And I'm going, "Well, yeah. So you're telling me homeopathy is free?" That when I go to these naturopathic clinics, they just do it out of the kindness of their heart, and there is no actual expense involved. And it's like, no. And I mean, especially when you consider homeopathy itself is water.
And on average, about 15% more expensive than prescription drugs.
Exactly. So, I mean...
Seriously?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. If we go to like London Drugs or a pharmacy, look at the price differential between like a package of Tylenol and its homeopathic equivalent. In many cases, what's kind of sad and depressing is that a lot of the big pharma companies have actually caught on to this and are starting to manufacture naturopathic remedies to charge more money for them.
Yeah,
it's quite shocking, actually.
So again, I mean, so you know, you have big pharma, but you have big fake pharma too, right? And I mean, they're both
big placebo as well. Sometimes referred to in skeptical circles.
Oh, I think fake pharma is better.
Well, you like the big part, though. The big placebo is cool.
Big placebo? Yeah. I like that term when you use it the first time here.
Okay.
So, yeah, that's my story. It was just basically get my news from you and learn some things about crazy woo.
What about, has there ever been a time when you heard something on Radio Freethinker that kind of challenged you or didn't agree with, or
oh yes I think I've been in disagreement with every single person.
To go to commercial.
I know this, but I can't remember particulars at the moment.
No, you can.
I mean, I?
Oh yeah, if you want to. But testimonials and being skeptical testimonials, you need the good and the bad, and the only way for our show to improve is to say, okay, we did these things right, and we did these things could have been better. Obviously, we've never done anything wrong, but we could have done them better.
I honestly can't remember. I wish you'd asked me beforehand.
Yeah, well, I'm not stupid. I mean,
but yeah, there's been times where I've disagreed with the show's conclusion on things.
Well, disagreement is good. I mean,
yeah.
We do encourage listeners to write in, email us, let us know if they see something that they disagree with, because, you know, one of the benchmarks for being a good skeptic is a willingness to entertain the idea that you're wrong.
Well, and also, too, again, to beat a dead horse sort of thing, one of the areas where we try and make ourselves a little different is going beyond the sort of science sort of limitations of a lot of skeptical shows. And when you go into things like history, politics, social science sort of things, there are not necessarily clear-cut answers. I mean, you can use your skeptical tools to sort of eliminate some of the chaff, but that doesn't mean you're going to come up with a black and white right answer. I mean, for example, homeopathy is nuts. Black and white, there is no question about that. But, when we've done a show, we did one a long time ago about our intervention to Libya, mm-hmm. right? And, I mean, we tried to put all the facts on the table, but, I mean, there was no black or white answer. And I'm sure there's a number of people who listened to our show who said, well, I agree with your facts, but I disagree with your conclusion. And you can do that as long as you're upfront about it. So tell us, Andrew, come on. There has to have been one.
Oh, you're pressuring me now.
Dude.
Well, pressure doesn't help memory, unfortunately. I'm sorry. Right.
We'll go back to that later in the show. We're going to speed through something a little extra because we weren't sure how long this last bit was going to take. So I'm going to do a little bit about New Year's resolutions. If it seems a bit rushed, well, tough. It's the end of the year, and you know, for some arbitrary reason, we think the first of the year is a great date to change our entire lives. But every year we make resolutions, and every year they seem to fade away along with the cold weather. This year I thought I might help by providing a few tips, probably most everyone kind of knows, that might help you keep your resolutions. First tip, size. Whatever resolution you make, try and make it manageable. Don't make your resolution to become the next Prime Minister of Canada or something. And I love this. I get my mother to do the editing because sometimes my spelling is horrible, and so she'll read it over. And I had originally said, you know, become the next Prime Minister because it ain't going to happen. And she puts in there, probably. Thanks, Mom. I'm definitely going to try and be the next Prime Minister of Canada because it can happen even for me. Thank you. I love that. But you need to make your resolutions both sort of realistic in a physical sense, as in something that you can do, but it also needs to be sort of realistic in sort of a psychological sense. And I don't think this was the best example I could come up with, but the one that came to mind is I could, in theory, say, hey, I want to become a marathoner this year. Now, I don't quite have the body for it, but let's pretend. To become a marathoner, it's more than just running a marathon. You have to get up every day or every couple days and do running. And I know my own psychological makeup, and that's, again, just not a me thing. So when you come up with something, it has to be something that's not only attainable physically, but something that suits your personality. And if you do that, you know, your goals become real. So, for example, this year, going to the gym once a month would be an improvement, but we'll say once a week. So it's small, mm-hmm. It's not over, it's something that I can do. It also needs specific. So again, to say I'm going to get healthy this year is a nice sort of general thing, but it needs to be something that is specific so you can say, this is what I'm going to do, and this is how I'm going to do it. So every Saturday, I'm going to go to the gym. Great. I've made a very specific goal, something that's attainable, something that's within my grasp. Ideally, I like to go maybe more times than once a week, but if you do the one, then you can always add on to it later, mm-hmm. and you'll have the strength of the first accomplishment to help improve it later on. The second one is to keep it simple. So every year there's so much you want to change about yourself. But if you try and change it all, you're just going to end up in limbo. You know, everyone has like 20 things I want to change. I want to change this. I want to change this. You should never have anything more than like five resolutions to do. And actually, I think one or two is the ideal number. The more things you try and do, the more you'll just basically stress you out, and the more likely you are to sort of abandon your goals altogether. Once you abandon one resolution, it becomes easier to abandon the second, and then the third, and soon, in a fit of despair and self-loathing, you say, screw it, I'm not going to do any of them. And of course, this actually ties into some research I was just listening to on NPR's Science Friday, where they were talking about willpower. And they were making the analogy of willpower as like a muscle. Everyone has a certain amount that they're sort of given with. With a bit of practice, you can kind of improve that, mm-hmm. but you have a limited amount. And if you just try and do everything, you just don't literally have the willpower. And they actually did some research where they, I'm trying to remember the actual research itself, but if you try and exercise your willpower on one object, and then you try and do it on a second thing, the second thing has a noticeable decline in your ability to do it, because you've sort of used up your willpower on the other one. And you can they actually use sugar water to re-energize your willpower. Wow. And they said they don't recommend using sugar in real life, but this was a lab and they had a limited amount of time, so they would quick charge it. But again, so try and keep it sort of simple, specific. Another thing is make it communal. So not every resolution can be done in a group. But the more people working on a similar goal, the better it is. When one's willpower sort of wanes, the others can help pull up the slack. Of course, you have to be careful as to what compatriots you take in when you do these resolutions, because if they themselves have sort of overloaded themselves, this sort of group thing can actually work against you, because if three people said, I don't want to do it this week, it gives you an excuse to yourself, say, okay, then I won't do it either. So choosing who you do this sort of group activity with is very important, but to do it in a group with people who are as dedicated as you are does help strengthen your ability to do it.
That's why one of the reasons why I think resolutions, like, instead of saying, I'm going to go to the gym every week, you know, get your best friends together and say, let's go for a big long bike ride once a week. You know, that changes it from kind of a gym, which is sort of like work, to, hey, I'm hanging with my friends. This is sort of fun.
Exactly.
You know?
And of course, and as you say, if it's like, you know, next week, I don't know if I really want to go. Come on, let's go. Yeah. Well, okay, I guess I'll go, right? And that helps, as long as you don't have slacker friends, which isn't too good, but... So another thing is to make it public. There's nothing like peer pressure and the thought of public failure to help one maintain resolution. Resolutions that are made in private can easily be forgotten or abandoned, as our internal rationale allows us to sort of explain why we can't do it. I can't do it because of this and the other. But when that sort of rationale is exposed to other non-biased people, it's often found, he said, well, no, actually, that's not really a good excuse not to do it. You know, when you talk to someone, it's actually, really, it just seems like you're making up an excuse. And that can help. But, of course, peer groups can also have the reverse effect. So there's all these things have to be sort of careful. You can sit there and say, well, I didn't really want to do this. Everyone else said I looked fat, so I didn't want to do this. You try eating just carrots for lunch or something like that. And you can get sort of this negative reinforcement. Mm-hmm. So again, one has to be careful on how you do it. But if you make sure that you have specific goals, there's realistic goals, there are specific goals they can use. And don't let failure... will you down? I mean, okay, so you don't go 1 week, right? Okay, that's not good, but it's not the end of the world. It's like not like now you have license to never go. Because again, January 1st, it's just a date on the calendar, mm-hmm. right? So if you forget 1 week and you go, okay, so February 13th, that's when I'm going to make my resolution. And from this point onward, I'm going to continue on with this goal. Again, you're trying to change something about yourself, ideally for the better. Don't set you up for failure, but don't let failure hold you back either.
Hmm. Well said. Let's go to one last commercial break, and we'll come back with our skeptical highlights here on Radio Freethinker. Woo-hoo!
The alphabet has only 26 letters. With these 26 magic symbols, however, millions of words are written every day.
Pick up your winter issue of Discorder, as the Jan-cember issue is packed with goodies that will warm even the coldest of cockles. Take a dip with Dixie's Death Pool, a spacey art rock collective, or read up on local outsider pop music makers, World Club. Cozy up on the couch with Filmstripped, featuring a review of Color Me Obsessed, a documentary on The Replacements. And in case you missed the memo, 2012 is almost here. Check out the Discorder album picks of 2011. Don't forget to pick up your special Jan-cember issue of Discorder.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So we are pretty much out of time, sadly. But we're going to go to our skeptical highlights. Don, you want to start us out?
I'll start us out with the Republic of Canada. As part of SFU's Philosopher's Cafe, moderator Roman Onofchuk questions why we live in a constitutional monarch with a new Canadian pledging allegiance to Queen Elizabeth rather than to Canadian Constitution or government. This talk is being held at the False Creek Community Center Thursday, January 15th at 7 p.m., it's a week after yours, right? Your talk is the 13th.
My talk is the 18th.
Oh, okay, good. So you can go to both of them.
Well, there are multiple philosopher cafes in Vancouver.
Yes. And it's free admission. So, again, this is one of those things that we've kind of talked about. We live in a constitutional monarchy. Should we turn to a republic? I don't mind being a monarchy. I think it's more of a historical throwover. It's sort of like having the beaver as our national anthem or the maple
beaver
leaf.
Beaver as national anthem?
Yeah, beavers sing. Oh, Canada.
Okay.
There's some beavers.
Yeah, well, step on their tits. They can sing anything. Okay, beaver as our national animal. Oh, Canada as our national anthem. Animal, sure. Anthem. Easy okay. To get confused.
All right, then.
But yeah, so I just thought people might be interested in that.
Okay. Well, I'll promote another Philosopher's Cafe, although this one is mine.
Self-serve.
Yes. Bearing witness to witness testimony, a skeptic's approach, my Philosopher's Cafe that I'm moderating is Wednesday, January 18th, 2012. That's at 7 p.m. at the Jewish Museum and Archives of British Columbia, 6184 Ash Street, Vancouver. It should be a very good evening, and I can say that because I'm going to be there.
So, two things come up with this. Because you're doing this in a Jewish museum, is this some form of support for Judaism? Have you become a Zionist over the period of time? Or
a Zionist?
Just a coincidental that it's being held there?
Zionist, wow.
Well, coincidentally, interesting enough, when I first got asked to do this, they gave me the location. I'm like, okay, well, where is this place? Because I don't want to do it if it's like in, Port Coquitlam or something. And so I'm trying to find it on Google Maps, and I can't find it. So,
it's part of the conspiracy.
Yeah, it's hidden, right? Anyway, I sort of locate it, and it's sort of like two buildings. One is the Jewish Museum and Archives. The other building attached to it is something like the Secular Association of Jewish People in Vancouver. So I'm like, which one am I in? I wonder. But actually, to be honest, I have been to talks by at the Jewish Museum and Archives. Fabulous people, some of the research they do, especially towards history and historiography about the Holocaust, is some pretty incredible work. So I'm quite honored, actually.
And obviously, I've just smacked down because Jewishness is one of those bifurcated things, because there's a religion and there's a cultural aspect of it.
Yep.
But another thing that I'm reminded of this, just for this curious thing, mm-hmm. On my other podcast, what you just did is they called log rolling.
Log rolling.
Where you promote yourself on your own show.
Yes.
Sort of, and I don't know why it's called log rolling, but I just thought that was a curious term.
Well, you know, I'm kind of shameless when it comes to self-promotion, as
most folks
know about me.
Yeah, I know everyone knows that when it comes to promoting the show, there is no one more of a W word than me.
Yeah.
I can't say it on the air because it'll offend some people.
Really?
Yeah. Do you have anything, Andrew, to show on this week?
Nothing much. I just recommend everyone to have a look at the best 18 TED Talks of the year. I've been watching them like crazy lately, so they're really, really something.
Yeah. TED Talks are quite an interesting thing. I've been listening to a lot of people talk about how, in one sense, this is sort of part of the 1% idea, because the TED Talks themselves are financed by a lot of rich people who donate money, mm-hmm. but in the other sense, it's actually one of the best forms of philanthropy, because the original TED Talks was a limited engagement. You paid like $18,000. It was private. There was like 3 people allowed in the room, sort of thing, and that was it. And then at one point, they flipped the switch and they said, well, listen, you're still going to have to pay the $18,000 to be in the audience, but we're going to put them on the internet, and anyone in every world can watch them for free. And it has just sort of flipped it on its head, and it's actually one of the more noble endeavors that we've had come out in recent times.
Well, not to mention the TEDx talks that are usually sort of student volunteer run, and we've had a couple of them at UBC, and also the fact that a number of prominent skeptics have done some pretty cool TED talks, James Randi, Sam Harris, among others. So definitely worth checking out. Well, folks, thanks for joining us this week on Radio Free Thinker. This is Ethan, your free thinking historian, saying thank you very much.
And this is Don, saying eyes open, minds on.
And this is Andrew, the mathematician and Don's friend, saying goodbye and thank you for having me.
Bye-bye, folks.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the star.